I'm beginning an interview this afternoon with John K. Simmons, Distinguished Service Professor of Accounting, the Pete Marwick Distinguished Service Professor of Accounting. And maybe I should start that off by saying KPMG, Pete Marwick, M-A-R-W-I-C-K, Distinguished Service Professor of Accounting, who was involved in setting up what became the Fisher School of Accounting at the University of Florida. This is March 1. We are doing this interview in my office here in the Museum of Florida, Museum of Natural History, and it's part of the University of Florida's Oral History Program. John, I want to start off, if I may, with some biographical information. Give me your full name, including tell me what that K stands for.
It's John Carl Simmons, the K-A-U-L. K stands for K-A-U-L, which is my mother's maiden name. It's a German name.
K-A-U-L. Mm-hmm. Where were you born?
I was born in Kansas.
Where?
Beloit, Kansas.
Where?
Beloit, Kansas.
That's spelled?
B-E-L-O-I-T, just like Beloit, Wisconsin, which is better known. It's a small town, about 4,000 or 5,000 people in north central Kansas.
And the date of your birth?
7/12/38.
All right. Now, tell me a little bit about your early education.
Well, there's something fairly unique in my background, I guess. Or a few years older, it may not be so unique, but because I was born and raised in a rural area, I did not actually go to kindergarten or the first grade. It was not convenient to do so. My mother had been a school teacher, and she actually taught me. And so when I got tested, and it's feasible for me to start school, I actually started in the second grade. And for 1 year, went to the old one-room schoolhouse with three students and a teacher. And they opened it up just for 1 year for us, and then decided that was not feasible and closed it down. And then I went to somewhat larger schools after that.
You were graduated from high school
in 1956.
Did you come from a rural family?
Yes. I was born and raised on a farm.
How did you become interested in accounting?
Well, they're a family of four boys, and I'm the youngest of the four. The one who's next youngest had gone to college, ended up getting a PhD in ag economics, as a matter of fact. And so I was, I guess, predetermined I was going to go to college. I always knew I was going to go to college. I took college preparatory courses in high school. And so it just became a matter of what I would take. And I had a scholarship in agriculture engineering with the agricultural background. And I started in that and decided that I did not like that. And I had taken some accounting courses, which I did like. And it was more a matter of having taken those first few courses in accounting and deciding I liked it. And there I went from there.
Where'd you go do your undergraduate work?
Kansas State University.
Where is that?
It's in Manhattan, Kansas.
And you received your degree there?
The bachelor's degree there.
Mm-hmm. What year?
In 1960.
And then you went on for graduate work?
During my senior year, they gave me the opportunity to teach a lab, which was unusual for an undergraduate student, but accounting in those days quite often had a regular class session and then a laboratory session, and they gave me the opportunity to teach a lab, and I enjoyed it, and so I started talking to faculty about the possibility of a master's degree and going on. I also interviewed with a couple of CPA firms, but decided to go on and get my master's degree.
And you then took an MBA where?
University of Denver.
And you, what was that, a one-year program?
One-year program. I also taught the entire time I was there.
And you went to the University of Denver. Why?
Oh, I'm choosing between several universities. The faculty at Kansas State had a high regard for that program, and I finally decided to stay in the same region for the master's degree. And they also gave me good fellowship support. It was one of the better offers I had.
And then from there, you went on to the PhD?
Straight on to Ohio State.
Why Ohio State?
Much the same reasons. I made my final choice of PhD program between Ohio State and Illinois, and basically chose Ohio State because the counsel I received was that the program was equally good and probably a little more friendly. And the support was about the same, maybe slightly better. And it was a close call, but I basically decided.
You took the PhD when?
Received it in 1967, actually, I think was the date. I really finished the coursework and everything in late 65 and went on to the faculty of the University of Minnesota and then finished the dissertation after the first year or two up there.
What was the extent of your teaching experience in those early years while you were going to graduate school and afterwards?
Well, as I mentioned, I was able to teach the lab as an undergrad student. Then as a master's student, I had full-time responsibility or with really not much supervision to do an elementary accounting course, which I taught both fall, winter, and summer. Actually, on the quarter system at Denver, so it would have been three quarters plus the summer. And then same thing at Ohio State. I taught full responsibility along with other PhD students the first and second accounting courses.
So you were teaching at the University of Minnesota before you received the PhD?
I went up there as an assistant professor without, you know, ABD, without the dissertation.
In 1965?
In 1965, and I think I actually received the degree officially in 1967.
And you stayed on at Minnesota until you came to Florida?
For 9 years, I went up through the ranks there, assistant associate professor. And then I really was only there, I guess, 1 year as a full professor and also as department chairman that year.
You moved very rapidly up the ranks, did you? Was that unusual, or?
I would say that it for that time period, people who were successful did move a little faster than they do today. That was I would say, on the fast side of average, but it would not be considered to be extreme fast track.
What was the status of accounting on the university level in the 1950s and the 1960s when you were making your choice and when you were going through?
I think it depended on the particular university. It was probably strongest at Ohio State. They were dominant in the College of Business, and they had a long history of outstanding faculty there over the years and made quite a reputation for themselves. I think they were more widely recognized on campus than, say, at Kansas State, which is my undergraduate school. University of Denver is also very strong. The two programs downtown were law and accounting, or well, law and business, of which accounting was a very strong component in business. So,
were accounting firms turning more and more to universities for the people that they were hiring?
I would think almost solely by that time that was really the, I think, near the beginning of the growth of accounting in terms of job opportunities, in terms of compensation, in terms of recognition. It was really really the start of a very significant growth period in accounting, both in the profession itself and in terms of the academic world. There's no doubt about what I hit the academic world in accounting at probably the best time that it, right at the very beginning, the best time. It stayed very good for a number of years after that.
I guess this is like a chicken and the egg question, but which came first? Was it the demand, or were you turning out more people and filling the gaps?
So the profession grew fast, and that created the demand, and it made accounting faculty very scarce. And that was after I'd made the decision to go into accounting. It really had nothing to, I sort of benefited from it. It had nothing to do with the actual decision itself. Although, part of the reason I took accounting courses initially was that I had received some feedback that accounting was a good field to go into. But never had anything to do with my decision to actually finally major in accounting, and certainly not to go on into teaching. But that was really the start of a very fast curve, growth curve in public accounting, which now, is leveled off today.
Now, I know that this is one of the reasons for setting up a special school on this campus, but what is causing the expansion of accounting? Is it because of increased government regulation and what?
Primarily, I don't think so. That has been a factor. I think it was simply the growth in the capitalization of companies, the number of companies, the amount of outside capital they were seeking, the requirement of audit opinions, growth, and even credit sources like banks, as well as shareholders requiring the audited financial statements. I think it just basically grew as that kind of activity grew. That growth, as I say, has leveled off some because we don't have that same rapid expansion that we did in the industry that we did back in those years either.
John, what brought you to Florida?
Well, as I mentioned, I had gone through all the ranks at Minnesota and had been promoted to full professor, and I was department chairman. Up there we had a rotating chairmanship, and it was kind of my turn to be chairman, and I liked being chairman. But I also liked being at the University of Minnesota. The thing that probably really started me to look was that I developed a serious sinus problem with the severe changes in weather up there. And it seemed like every year it got worse. And by the time I was there 9 years, it seemed like somehow I had become more sensitized to it. And one of the things a doctor told me one time when I had a particularly tough winter, that I was running a low-grade virus fever for several weeks, and he said, what I think I better do is write you a prescription to go down in the sunshine and get rid of this. And I got to thinking, thought, well, maybe it's better just to move. So,
I started looking. Did you recruit the university, or did they recruit you?
They recruited me. Again, I was not seriously looking, but another event that happened at the same time was a friend of mine had gone to the University of Tennessee a couple of years before and had, this was actually before I'd become full professor, and had asked me to recruit down there. And at the same time, I'd also talked to University of Florida and decided not to move at that time. And then when I started looking for chairmanships, don't remember exactly what happened. Somebody from University of Florida did contact me and asked me if I was interested in being a candidate for the chairmanship. And I decided that I wanted to take a look at it. So I was one of the three candidates that came down.
So you were not soliciting. They came to you.
They came to me, but I certainly was receptive, was interested. I guess actually when I say I decided to look around, I don't think I ever really had made the decision enough to tell people I was looking around. But when somebody approached me, well, then I was ready to look. It's interesting. I was on the Dean Search Committee in Minnesota at the same time, and one of the candidates was Bob Angelotti. And it was kind of an interesting issue whether he was going to go there and be dean or I was going to come down here and be department chairman.
Was it Bob who was working with you and bringing you down?
No, actually, I don't think Bob, they had a search committee. D. Ray, I don't know if you know D or not. D. Ray chaired the committee. D's retired now. And it really was a faculty committee that screened candidates and invited three people in.
Were you getting other offers at the time?
Getting other inquiries. At that particular time, though, I did not make any visits other than the University of Florida.
Did you know about the university?
Because I'd been down here 2 or 3 years earlier, I knew some things about it. When I'd interviewed at associate or full professor that I interviewed a few years before that, I knew something about it.
How did the university's programs stack up at the time compared with other institutions in the U.S.?
I think that the university had a good reputation, but it did not have the same reputation that a Minnesota or Ohio State had at that time, not in business and accounting. And I think there actually was a survey, done just before I came down that I saw after I had already accepted. Somebody sent a copy to me, and the accounting program ranked about 27th, 28th in the country based upon that survey. Of course, rankings are not perfect by any means, but whereas now we consistently rank in the top 10, at least that particular survey was ranked at about 27th to 28th. So there was a long and solid history here. It also was a situation where in accounting, and that's one reason I came here, accounting was had a number of vacancies and a number of faculty about ready to retire. And some alumni had come in and told Dean Lanzalotti it was time to move and do something with accounting. And so you had all those combinations of variables that really made it seem attractive.
So you saw some good potential then?
Very much so. And that and the final analysis is what caused me to come down here.
Now, when you came down, of course, we were in the middle of a recession.
Just after that.
And the dollars were very few.
Yeah. I made the decision in the fall of 73. I actually made, and I was also chairman of Minnesota that same year, and I really ran two departments almost because I came down in January and made several trips and hired some people to start that following fall, even though I was not in place. And I also did the planning for the teaching program that following fall, and did all of that before I actually came here in July of 1974. So all of that proceeded, and then it was during that first year I was here that we got into a situation of a tight budget and zero raises for faculty. But that lasted just a fairly, it's not like this time around, it lasted a very short amount of time.
When you came down to interview, you met with the faculty and the college.
That's right. Particularly the accounting faculty, made a presentation to the accounting faculty, talked to all of them individually, met some of the department chairpersons, at least in the college. I don't recall meeting in any general college faculty meeting or a general accounting faculty meeting. And met with, of course, spent quite a bit of time with Bob Lanzalotti, the dean, and talked to Bob Bryan briefly, who was then, He was assistant vice president. He actually was not vice president yet at that point.
You talked to Marston?
Did not talk to Marston on that trip, no. Matter of fact, I don't think he was here yet. He was not here at the time I interviewed. I'm not sure who was, in fact, whether it was an acting president. I don't recall. Pre-Marston, I haven't paid a lot of attention to the timing of things, but I don't think Marston was actually in place. He came in about the same time I did.
Now, you're married by this time, of course.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
To whom?
Wife's name is Gail. We met at Kansas State, and we had been married all the way through my graduate studies.
And you had children?
Two daughters.
What are their names?
Colleen, that's spelled like my middle name, Kaulen, is the oldest, and Laura is the youngest.
When you yourself decide to make the move, obviously, you're discussing your family. Are they in support of this?
Yes. My wife, of course, came down with me, and even on the first trip, and spent the same time that I did here, and she was very supportive. Our two daughters, who were then probably in about the third and sixth grade, did not come down, but we talked to them about the fact we could have a swimming pool down here and things like that. And
blackmail them.
they're obviously a little reluctantly friend, but it was not a problem. They were ready to go.
How'd you like Gainesville?
We liked it a lot. We had a transition to make because we had lived in Minneapolis, St. Paul, a big city, in Columbus, Ohio, which is a reasonably big city, and my wife found particularly the shopping transition to be a bit difficult, but there were many things that made up for that. So, no, we liked Gainesville.
Particularly your sinuses.
Yes, that's right. And we met a lot of friendly people, and we were a little worried about the school system coming down from Minneapolis, which was a great school system for kids, but we debated about whether to put our kids in public or private schools, and we left them in public schools, and we had very good luck with it.
Was the dollar offer good?
Dollar offer was good, yes. It was not the decided factor.
Was it better than you were getting it in Minnesota?
Well, of course, it was on a 12-month basis, whereas up there I was on a 9-month basis. And if you transcribed it to 12 months, it would have been an increase. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I would say it was an astounding increase, but it was definitely an increase.
So all things considered, you felt you had made a good career move.
Yes. Yeah, I never had any serious doubts. Not even really go through a second thought process after I made the decision. I think one of the reasons for that, though, is I got involved very quickly and came down and spent some time in January and actually went out to the University of Texas and interviewed some people for Florida. Had one person that came down to interview when I was not here fly through Minneapolis so I could talk to him. And so from the very beginning, as soon as I made the decision, I got involved and laying the groundwork to hire some people and also planning the teaching program for the following year. So I really didn't have a chance to even stop and reflect, I guess, in terms of whether I'd made the right decision or not.
Now, nearly 20 years later, do you think you've made the wrong decision?
No, it was a very good move. Very good move. And I've had a number of inquiries about going somewhere else to be a dean, even up until the last year or so. I expect some of those to start diminishing as I get older and I'm farther away from administration, but I've had a lot of inquiries and I've flirted with it a little bit, but I've never actually gone on a visit because I still think it's a good place to be. And plus, I have a very strong vested interest in the School of Accounting.
And you feel that the status of the school and the college has grown now so that if you or someone else wanted to make the move, it's a good launching pad.
Oh, yes, and no doubt has launched some people. And it no doubt had a favorable impact on some aspects of my career as well. Mm-hmm. As the school became successful, well, certainly that brought some recognition to me as well.
So. Now, as a chairman during a transitional period here at the university, you had obviously to recruit and hire people. What other responsibilities did you have when you first arrived?
There were several things. Recruiting was clearly the biggest one. As I say, we had several open lines, which never really got frozen, as I recall, even in that one bad year. If they were frozen, it was a very short time. And Bob Lanswein promised some new lines. So we hired something like, I would forget the exact number, but something like maybe 16 people in 5 years, something like that, first 5 years. So recruiting was a very big part of it. And once we had several successful hiring, some acceptances, well, then it seemed to do very well. Recruiting went very well. But there were some other things, like the faculty were mainly teaching 5 days a week when I came here. And one of the things I did was to get special approval from primarily, I guess, academic affairs to go on a split teaching schedule where they would split, they would teach a session and part of a session and do it 3 days a week instead of these old 1 hour, 5 day a week so that they could free up some time to do some research and some other things. We had done that in Minnesota. It was not necessarily an original idea with me. It's just that I'd seen other places that worked so much better to do that sort of thing. And almost immediately then, this issue of the school accounting came up. We did not raise it here initially. It was raised elsewhere. It had become, within a year or two before that, it had become a topic of some national discussion. And so we went to work on that right away. So it, and then that became very time consuming.
What was your commitment? What is your commitment to research?
I had done the necessary research to go up through the ranks at the University of Minnesota. One of the articles I wrote, in fact, at that time, won the outstanding contribution to literature and accounting for that year. And since then, I have not been involved in the, I got off in administration, and then when I came out of administration, I got involved in probably what could best be described as national organization and policy issues. And so the writings I have done since I came here have been more dealing with issues and policy rather than what you would term basic research.
Well, let me broaden the question a little bit. What is your commitment to research as far as the college is concerned, your faculty is concerned, right from the very beginning when you arrived? Did you have research scholars on the accounting faculty?
There was not a great deal of research being done, and the I wanted to follow a balanced approach, but there were two things, all three areas I think needed work, but research needed to be improved. Another thing that needed to be improved was that the alumni were somewhat unhappy with the relationships between the faculty and the public accounting individuals. That's one reason they had approached Bob Lanzalotti and said it was time to start doing something different. It was time for a change. And so my model for communicating to faculty what I wanted them to do and what I was going to reward them on was a three-step model, a three-dimensional model, which was that I wanted to emphasize across all faculty teaching, research, and service. And so service was a bigger obligation than it would be, say, in most units on campus at that time, particularly professional interaction service. But the commitment to research was strong, and that was certainly one of the areas we needed to build. And we developed an accounting research center. I initiated that and brought in a person who was known in a chaired position. He only stayed a year and left, but then we brought in the second person in that same position. And he really then developed the accounting research center, and he's still here today as a graduate research professor, and that's Rashad Abdul-Khalid.
What about the enrollment for the college and in accounting? It was rising in the 60s and 70s?
Very much so. And one of the first things we did, or the, again, I did, we did, but at my initiation, was to raise admission standard in accounting. We had a 30% increase, as I recall, in the first or second year I was here. I don't remember now, or just the first year, maybe the first 2 years combined, but 30% increase in enrollment. The university does not provide resources to keep up with that kind of pace. And one of the first things we did, and I think it's been one of the factors in our success, is that we started raising admission standards.
From what to what?
Oh, we basically went from, it was a scale based upon how many pre-professional courses they had completed out of a set of maybe six courses that we stipulated pre-professional courses to the College of Business at that time. And accounting today, we still have about the same set as the college, but it's slightly different. And if they had completed all of those, I think I don't remember whether it was a 2.0 or 2.5, but we essentially went up to 2.8 if they had not completed, or if they had completed all of them, and about a 3.0 if they had only completed one or two. So we basically went from a C to a C plus average up to a very strong C plus to a B average to get into accounting.
Is that what it is today?
Today it's a very, very clear-cut B average. And also then, because we emphasize the five-year program, we've also added the at least to the admission to the five-year program, we've also added the GMAT.
When you arrived on the scene, what year again was that, 74?
74 when I actually came.
You say that there was already discussion about setting up an independent school of
accounting? Not here. There had been a meeting at the University of Texas where several people had talked about that issue. There had been a recommendation come out of the American Institute of CPAs that that'd be one of the things that is one of the things they'd like to see as part of several developments in accounting education. So there had been some suggestion at the national level that this should be thought about. And there were maybe two schools who, by the time I had, certainly by the completion of the first year, let's say, that I was here, had moved in that direction. University of Missouri had moved in that direction, and Brigham Young University, I think, by that time had moved in that direction.
Those were the two pioneers.
We were one of four. I think the other one who was in that four might have been the University of Denver, if I remember right.
What were the catalysts that began that thinking here in Florida?
Well, I knew we had to
off the campus.
Yeah, I knew that we needed to look at our curriculum and professional program, and so I appointed a faculty committee, first of all, to look at the professional program, dimensions of a good professional program, because there had in fact been a publication issued by the AICPA on professional programs of accountancy.
What's the AICPA?
AICPA is American Institute of CPAs, and they had issued a booklet. There had been a study group on standards, a study board on standards for professional accounting, and I don't remember the exact title, but something like that. So it was time they just set up a committee.
Who was on your committee?
I probably could not recall four or five of the faculty, without going back and looking at the names. But it was a combination of faculty who had been here for a while, but mostly dominated by people who had just come in, because we had such a turnaround so quickly of newer people.
And did you have representation from off the campus?
Not at that time. Now, that committee came back to a faculty meeting with some recommendations, and one of the things they raised was that, you know, we probably should start thinking seriously about a school of accounting, in addition to just changing the curriculum and the certain aspects of the program, we ought to think about school of accounting. So
they really went a little bit beyond your original charge.
I don't remember the exact charge. I may have included that at least as something to consider in the charge. Certainly I brought it to their attention. And what I did then was I presented drew up a little chart about different things a school of accounting would entail, and gave that to a committee that was 10 people, these same five faculty plus five practitioners. All of these practitioners were alumni except for one.
Was Al Warrington in at the beginning?
Al Warrington was one of those people. Also, at that same time, during that first year, we had organized what we still call a steering committee, and Al Warrington was very involved in that. And so I'd worked closely with him and with others in raising the general fundraising effort, and so that had really ratcheted up. It really had increased quite a bit. And that first year, they were first time they'd been very active with the steering committee. It really was just been organized at that point. So we had this faculty committee working, which we then added five people from the steering committee to. We had the steering committee itself, which was very active, and so that the sort of working partnership with the outside profession really got going, became strong during just that first year or so. It was really kind of surprising how fast it happened.
Did you realize when you came that you were going to be involved in fundraising?
Yes. I did not know that we were going to be involved in the extensive fundraising to create a school, but I knew that fundraising was one of the things that needed attention. And one of the very first things we did was to go around the state with two or three meetings, meeting with alumni. Al Warrington really arranged these meetings, and Bob Lanzalotti and I, and Willard Stone, who was the previous chairman, went along. And that happened, actually, that may have happened before I physically arrived on the scene, or if not, it happened within the first month or so after I was here. Mm-hmm. And the steering committee was organized, and we started fundraising efforts, but just for general enrichment of the program, not for a school at that point. But
who else besides Al Warrington off the campus was involved?
Doug Thompson was pretty actively involved.
Doug Thompson?
Thompson.
From where?
He's still in Gainesville. He was with the State Board of Accountancy at the time and is a Florida graduate.
Douglas Thompson.
Mm-hmm. And he's very active here in Gainesville. He's still around.
Who else?
There are a lot of individuals. A fellow that just recently passed away, Ed Triplett, was involved. Not quite at the same level as Al or Doug, but very much involved. A fellow by the name of Bob Ellison was involved during a key period of time.
From where?
From Cooperson Library in Miami. He's still there. I think about due to retire maybe this year. A fellow by the name of Fred Edenfield, who headed up a fairly large firm down in Fort Myers, was very much involved. Keith Austin, here in Gainesville, was involved in some of the initial stages of setting up the school. And as a matter of fact, that the five people that served on that committee with the five faculty that finally came back with a recommendation of a school included Al Warrington, and Keith Austin, and Jay Skelton. Jay was the only one who was not an alumnus. He was with Pete Marlick in Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, so we had Fred Edenfield, Keith Austin, Al Warrington, Jay Skelton, and I believe the fifth person on that actual committee was Bob Ellison. Although, as I say, Doug Thompson was very much involved at that time, too. So those are really the initial set of people.
What do you mean by enrichment funding? I noticed that appears in the correspondence and in the discussion at the time.
Funds would allow us to do the things that we needed to do to make our program stronger. Faculty support for research in the summer. Faculty travel to be able to participate in professional meetings, some student scholarships. There were a category of things that came into that heading of enrichment.
I gather this was very successful from the first year that you were involved, that it went from 10,000 to, I don't know, 40,000 or
something
more.
40 and 50, I think.
40 or
yes,
50,
and one of the key individuals there was Al Warrington. There was another key individual who is still around that was very much involved in that first fundraising effort before the school. I mean, just for the general
enrichment. Before the school, yeah.
And his name is Terry Lyle. He's down in Tampa. Terry was with Pete Marwick and Mitchell at the time. He then left Pete Marwick with Jack Eckert for a while and is now retired. But Terry and Al sort of had a duel going as to who could raise the most funds, Arthur Anderson or Pete Marwick. Both of those are CPA firms. And Terry actually beat out Al, much to Al's chagrin. And we had an alumni function after a football game in the fall of the very first year, 1974, when we announced these fundraising efforts. So yes, it did happen very quickly.
And I noticed also from the correspondence that you had major fundraising efforts in Tampa and in Miami and in Jacksonville.
Those were the three meetings I mentioned that we had either right after I got here, or it may have been I came down specially for them before I physically moved. I don't remember the exact timing. I think it may have been within the first month after I arrived.
And you were seeking donations from individuals and firms that could be used by your department. mm-hmm. for whatever you felt was necessary to enhance the operation.
That's right.
So and these were unrestricted funds.
Unrestricted funds. And as I say, that went from a total of like something like 8 or 9 or under 10, I think.
To about 50.
To about 50 in that first year.
These were donations given to you through the foundation?
Most of them came in. Yes, they came in and they all ended up in the foundation. Some of them came up directly to me. Some of them had the University of Florida written on them. We always had that problem then trying to get them in the foundation account. We actually deposited a few of those individual checks in miscellaneous grants because they were made at the University of Florida. But yeah, the objective was, and by far the majority of them ended up in the foundation account.
Al Warrington then was your strongest off-campus.
He was the first chairman of the steering committee in that very
Who
first
is
year.
Al Warrington?
Al is a graduate of the program that was with Arthur Anderson for most of his career. And when I knew him, had become the managing partner of the Miami office of Arthur Anderson. And he is a... I think his blood, if he could bleed, would be blue and
and
blue and orange.
An avid Gator.
Yes, and of course, as you probably know, he's been president of the Alumni Association. That happened afterwards. He had not been yet at that time. But Al has, I mean, there are a lot of people from the outside who were a factor in creating the school, but no one is quite at the same level as Al Warrington. Al was clearly the most helpful person.
He continues his dedication.
Yes, he does. He's still on the steering committee and still comes back and attends most of the meetings, even though he now is located in Houston.
I was going to say, he's moved from Florida to Texas now.
Yes,
that doesn't stop him.
His heart's still back here.
That's right. You see him on the plane a couple of days before every football game.
He usually has on his orange jacket, so you can't miss him.
I know Al very well. When was he here in school?
Oh, you know, I'm going to have to guess. He certainly told me several times, but I think it probably was around, my guess would be maybe 61 or 2.
Well, I'm going to interview him also mm-hmm. in this project, so I'll get all the specific bio information. I'm not sure. I wouldn't want to count on it, but I think he was once in my class. But so was everybody else in the world. Now, he was followed by Fred Edenfield.
Right.
1975.
And we did that. We did that. I did that purposely to try to go from a national firm representative to a smaller local firm representative to get those people more involved.
Tell me who he is, Fred Edenfield.
Fred, when I met Fred, Fred's also one of our graduates. When I met Fred, he was the managing partner of Taylor Edenfield, Wiltshire, and had another name on it, down in Fort Myers. That firm has since merged in with Coopers & Libren, but it was a very...
Coopers what?
Coopers & Libren.
How do you spell that?
Well, Coopers, C-O-O-P-E-R-S, and Libren, L-Y-B-R-E-N-D, it's one of the big six CPA firms. And Fred was a very successful firm, and I'm sure Al was the one that pointed Fred out to me, and Fred was very active in that first year, and then so I asked Fred to chair the steering committee in the next year to swing it to a local person. So, of course, Al continued to work hard also, but Fred was the chairman of the second year.
And then he was succeeded by Robert Ellison.
Bob Ellison then is with Coopers & Libren and the Miami office. And Bob was one of the people who was probably not quite as involved in the fundraising efforts during that first year or two, but was very closely associated with the school and had been one of the people who had talked to Bob Lanzalotti about the need for change before I even came. And so we asked Bob to be chairman the third year, and he actually then was chairman of the steering committee and acted as master of ceremonies at the event down in Tampa with the Board of Regents where we had the celebration to announce the signing of the creation of the school.
This was a critical period for setting up a school, wasn't it? Were you getting strong support then from these three men and their cohorts?
Yes, there's no doubt but what we could not have done it without the strong support of the alumni.
So there's no, everybody then felt that there was the need for a school of accounting.
Well, not everybody, but those practitioners who worked with us closely, and our faculty thought so. We had to convince, of course, other people that that was the case.
You had to convince other people in the business faculty?
Yes, though that went fairly well, but we had to convince, of course, first the dean, and then the College of Business faculty, and I visited with each department individually, explained what we wanted to do. And then, of course, the central administration, right up to the Faculty Senate and the Board of Regents. And there were a lot of other programs that tried to do the same thing about the same time, and they were not able to get it through the university. So it became, you know, we were fortunate in that sense that we could make the case and it was accepted.
What role did Bob Lancelotti play in all of this?
We had to present it to Bob. And we had a meeting where this committee of faculty and alumni that I talked about and myself asked for a meeting with Bob, told him what it was about, and we met with Bob and made our case. And this was late in the day, probably in conjunction with football weekend, as I recall, maybe on a Friday. And Bob said, let me think about it overnight. And we scheduled a meeting for the following morning. And Bob came back and said, well, don't remember his exact words, and you can see when you talk to Bob, he does, but he basically said, it's an interesting idea, he said, and if you can raise $1 million to launch it successfully, then I'll support it.
But this didn't come as any surprise to him. He must have known what was going on.
I think it surprised him. I mean, certainly I suppose he'd heard some general discussions maybe around the country, or maybe not, because it still was fairly soon. But we had not really talked about it with him specifically before that time.
So you and your steering committee then came up with a plan of operation, and you present this to the dean of the college.
That's correct. And then Bob, very quickly on an overnight thinking about it, agreed to get on the bandwagon. But the key thing was that when this committee met, I had outlined to them the various stages the school could be. It could be a change in name only, just change the name of a department to a school. It could be a completely freestanding school of accounting. You know, we're just thinking about concepts here. Or it could be a school that had certain specified autonomies. And, of course, the autonomies you could specify, one or several of, would be budget, curriculum, promotion and tenure, those three primarily. And I've laid this out in the document. This committee, not me, this committee came back with the decision that we should try to pursue a freestanding school of accounting. And that's then what we were trying to
sell. Was that pretty revolutionary?
Pretty revolutionary, but two of the CPA firms now at the national level, not like a Miami office or a Jacksonville office, but their national home offices, had indicated that they thought this was a good idea. And one firm, Ernst at the time, now called Ernst & Winnie, their national foundation had said, we'll allocate X amount of dollars for a school of accounting, we'll allocate X plus, and I forget the exact amount, but it's significantly more, for a school of accounting that's willing to experiment for freestanding school. And again, that was not one of the things that made our decision for us, but that was out there for people to think about, and certainly was a factor.
Why did you feel that a freestanding school was advantageous over having an expanded department within the college? You know, it's bureaucracy and red tape and all of those kinds of administrative headaches.
First of all, I laid out the choices, and I did not actually make the choice. The faculty and the alumni did, though I certainly supported it. But
was your heart behind? That's really
yes,
what I'm asking.
Yes, it was.
If you had to make the choices, you would have selected the independent school?
I would have, though I would have gone and I would have supported any of the choices that the faculty and alumni.
I understand that, but I mean, in your inner heart, this is what you hope would happen?
Yes, and there were a number of programs around the country at that time that were starting to hope that that would happen. For the obvious reasons, I mean, why have a separate school or college of anything, law or journalism or any professional field? It's that you can control your own destiny. You can establish your own curriculum without having people worry too much about vested interests. And you can just basically set your own standards and responsibilities within the general university guidelines rather than some other peer discipline guidelines. And it's just really the same argument that you would raise for any college or school.
When Lancelotti agreed to this after this overnight thinking about it, did he then become a coach, or was he just an interested spectator?
I don't think coach would be the right word, but he was very much an active participant. Mm-hmm. Bob and I went on fundraising trips together to New York to try to raise big amounts of money now for the School of Accounting. We made at least one trip to New York together. We made some other trips together. He was an active participant, not so much in the definition of exactly what we were going to do, but certainly got very involved in the fundraising effort. He was very much an active participant.
Was there any move within the college itself to say, we don't need this, we should not be allocating scarce dollars to this?
Yes. Again, Bob was a strong enough dean that once he'd made up his mind to commit to it, that he was able to, I think, head some of that off. I do understand, I could not confirm this, Bob might be able to if he remembers. I do understand that the other department chairman did contact him informally and say, we don't think this is a very good idea. And
the time is not right yet.
But Bob basically didn't let that go anywhere. It was at Bob's suggestion, the dean's suggestion, that I go around and talk to the individual faculty. And so I met with each of the other units in the college and explained to them what it is we wanted to do, tried to explain what I thought would, tried to assure them that there would be no harm to them, it would not be detrimental in any way to them, and also held out the fact that because we were going to be using some outside resources, we could pull out of certain things that were in tight supply within the college, such as the summer research money. We said we'd pull out of that, furnish our own, such as copying costs. We were going to set up our own separate facilities for that. And a number of things like that that I tried to use somewhat to convince the others that, hey, you're going to benefit from this, you're not actually going to be hurt by it. But the tricky issue, of course, was the freestanding, and as you see from some of the correspondence, that ran into some problems as we proceeded with it.
Why the $1 million?
That basically was a price tag that Bob set. And he thought, I cannot tell you all the reasons why he felt that that was the right figure. I suppose it may be, well, I knew that we would need to raise sums of money. I certainly had set no amount in my mind, nor do I think the others had either. So it was the amount that Bob came up with.
Is it because he thinks big, or did he particularly set a high mark thinking you might not make it?
I could not answer that. It might be a little bit of both. It could be either, because Bob certainly does think big. He did a lot for the college. And it may also have been that he really didn't want to do this. Bob did tell me one time afterwards that I had put him in a situation where he had put a lot of pressure on him. Now, I hadn't thought much about that because I've never seen Bob be concerned about having pressure put on him. And if you know Bob very well, well, you might, I see you're nodding your head, might agree with that too. So I didn't worry much about putting Bob in a situation where, because Bob can handle his own anywhere. But he did tell me once afterwards that I put him in an awful heavy pressure situation when I asked him to meet with this faculty and alumni group and that presentation and asked him to commit to it. So I'm sure he had some mixed thoughts about it. Another factor on the $1 million, though, was we're trying to get priority to either build a new building or remodel Bryan at the time. And I think he, in part, wanted to use the $1 million as leverage to get, and it did in fact happen that we got this, accounting really was responsible for the new building being built when it was. The $1 million was used as leverage to move it up into priority. It did not build the building, it all went to programs, and that was understood from the beginning. That $1 million commitment was used as leverage to increase the priority, which caused what's now BUS to be built when it was, rather than, who knows, sometime in the future.
So
a matter of fact.
End of tape A, side one. The interview continues with tape A, side two.
Bob Lancelotti's role in all of this. And you're saying?
Well, I was saying that we could not have done it without Bob Lancelotti. As to what all his motives were in terms of his accepting it, I don't know. He received a lot of flack from other deans because you can imagine most deans did not want to let accounting out, certainly, and turn to freestanding, let alone have more autonomy than, and certainly not even have more autonomy than other units. So Bob took a lot of
flack
from the deans.
Now you're saying other deans or other chairs within the college?
Really more around the country, other deans of business. Other deans of business. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is we could never have done it without his support.
But I gathered from what you had said earlier that there was a trend in this direction, encouraged by the accounting firms, to have freestanding schools of accounting. So what Florida was doing seemed to be part of this national move.
That did not mean that universities accepted it and that other deans of business accepted it. As a matter of fact, they organized against it to try to halt it. Basically, the organization of deans of business did not want to see this happen.
They felt that it was a dilution of their power?
Yes. I think certainly that probably was the highest ranking reason. There were a lot of reasons they gave, you know, the interaction was necessary and, you know, the mutual support of the programs and so forth. There were a lot of reasons that were given, but there was that they opposed, and another development going on that was separate but very strongly overlapping was the development of the 150-hour program. And the two topics were very closely related, a professional school accounting and a 150-hour graduate degree-oriented program. And the deans collectively across the country very strongly opposed it. And so in that sense, if Bob had not been willing to go out on a limb, we could not have done it. At the same time, of course, as we started to evolve the school, well, then the questions of what it really meant here on campus to be freestanding and living up to the commitments that were made became an issue from time to time. And we were breaking new ground, and I understand that that gave Bob and the university some problems, but as we got into it, some of those same issues that other deans were concerned about became issues here as well.
I noticed that you share the dean, that the dean of the college is also the dean of the school. Was that a compromise? We're a little bit jumping ahead here, mm-hmm. but it fits in with what we're talking about now.
We wanted to, number one, have Bob's support. And he did get on board and seemed fairly excited about it. And he was a very strong dean. We wanted him to be dean of the School of Accounting. There was never thought otherwise, at least when Bob was there. Ultimately, we thought there might be a separate dean. But we wanted Bob to be the dean. And so we tried to work out what relationship would allow that. And it was our idea then that he would simply be both the dean of the School of Accounting and the dean of the college. And we really carried that idea all the way through the proposal and through administration and all the way to the Senate meeting when somebody raised the question and said, hey, you can't do this. The university constitution does not allow a school to be headed by a dean, and so something has to be worked out here. And so basically what we did was try to work out a compromise, but still maintain the operational activity of the school in a freestanding mode. And that's what later gave us some problems because we had the compromise kept us in the College of Business, but said we're going to operate freestanding as though you were totally free. And, of course, then definitional issues started coming up in the years ahead.
Now, once again, as you look back on it, nearly two decades, was it wise to have the dean of the college also the dean of the school?
I don't think it would have been feasible to do anything else.
It wasn't feasible when you started. I just wondered, with the passage of time, whether that was a strength or a weakness.
I think that there still is some feeling on the part of many that it would be better, and it still comes up. Somebody will make the comment once in a while among our faculty that it would still make more sense for us to have a freestanding school of accounting. I think from a political sense, that's just not going to happen. And one of the things that's happened that over time since we were thinking about that is that other programs have not been successful in bringing that about. And also the curriculum of accounting has probably become a little bit more integrated than it was then. So I think now on balance we feel that since many of the wrinkles with other units in the college have now been worked out, you know, we've kind of gotten by the sticky period when they were sort of challenging us on things and creating some problems. I think now we have a pretty good relationship in the college, and I think on balance that the solution has worked out to be to be pretty good. Is it best? Would we be better off if we'd gone the other way? If the university had lived up to its original commitment for us to be freestanding? That's hard to judge. Mm-hmm. But I think we're reasonably content most of the time with where we are today.
Were you successful in achieving that $1 million goal?
Yes.
Who did you get the money from?
We got it from a variety of sources, mostly from the CPA firms. We got Arthur Anderson was a large contributor.
That's Al Warrington.
Al Warrington was mainly responsible for that. But you see, this money had to come not just from alumni, but from foundation as well. So we had to secure a commitment from the foundation.
How much you get from them?
I think it was $150,000, as I recall, over a six-year time period. Mm-hmm. It was not all up front, but a commitment over a six-year time period. I think the commitment from Coopers and Librem was $140,000, again, over a six-year time period. From Ernst, what was then Ernst & Ernst, now Ernst & Whinney, it was $125,000. And interestingly enough, as I mentioned before, they were the ones who supported a freestanding school. And their letter said, we'll commit $62,500 over 6 years. And if you really then do become freestanding, as you say, as the university says you're going to, we'll give you the other $62,500 at the end of the period. So they were the strongest on the freestanding. But we had raised all this money on the notion we were going to operate freestanding. Dwight Haskins and Sells, $45,000.
Now, where are they?
They again, that's one of the big six firms. They've now merged, and they're part of it's Deloitte and Touche, but at the time it was Haskins and Sells. And then Pete Marwick actually came in about a month or two after the deadline and with $50,000 commitment, so we kind of include it, but they actually... What we actually had to do was to get some temporary individuals, we got a temporary fund, we got some individuals to sign pledges amounting to about $50,000 to make the $1 million with the notion that those pledges could be eliminated if we got some more funding, and Pete Marwick came in very soon after that. Also, the State Board of Accountancy had originally pledged $200,000 out of their trust funds. They were able to make, I think, about a $40,000 payment out of that, and then the state shut them down and said, hey, we can't let you do this. So we never got all of that $200,000. And then the Ring Foundation, which is a foundation of the Florida Institute of CPAs, made a commitment of about $100,000.
This is not Alfred Ring, then?
No, it had nothing to do with him. I'm trying to think who it was. Or the Ring, they don't call it the Ring Foundation anymore. It is now just the FICPA Foundation, but it was called the Ring Foundation at the time, and I don't remember where the name Ring came from. There was a CPA firm a lot of years ago called Mahoney and Ring and something, and I suspect that's who it was. And then we got some individual contributions, about $25,000. The North Central local CPA chapter gave us $5,000, and we had then individuals, including myself, that took out life insurance policies. The university still has my life insurance policy, which had face value about $90,000, and that people were paying premiums on. That actually added up to about $1,200,000.
You did not go to banks and other agencies like that, financial agencies?
We tried a few separate foundations. And we found that foundations like the Arthur Vining Davis Foundation basically want to give to the liberal arts programs on campus. And so the few foundations, and there are only maybe one or two or three we approached, we just did not have any success with.
The College of Business has been successful over the years in approaching individuals. Mm-hmm. Were you able to do that with the School of Accounting?
No.
Before you got to Fred Fisher?
No. Al Warrington of Arthur Anderson was able to get a fairly large contribution from one of his tax clients of some land in Miami that we later sold at a significant profit. We talked to Al Warrington and Bob Langelotti, and I went down and talked to a person, an individual who had started in accounting, had become wealthy outside of accounting, and we tried to get him to commit a large sum of money, and we were not successful. So we tried a few individuals we were not successful with. And the success with Fred Fisher came later after the school was already in place.
Now, You achieved the goal of the $1 million, which Bob Lancelotti had set down for you. How about at this point then tracing the development of the program through the various agencies on campus until it becomes a reality, before it gets to the Board of Regents, perhaps?
The proposal was going forward at the same time that the $1 million were being raised. So that was not sequential. Those activities were going on at the same time. And, of course, it went through all the stages at the university. The curriculum committee first had to review it. First, of course, we sent it over to Gene Hemp and Bob Bryan and got their approval at least to process it.
Were they supportive right from the beginning?
Yes. Yeah, there was never any serious opposition there. I don't know what questions they had in their own mind. I know that Bob Bryan, from some things he said then and some things he said later, is concerned about what implication this might have elsewhere on campus for others. And
But Gene Hemp was really the financial wizard. Was he supportive?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But Bob was a policymaker. Bob Bryan, of course, was a policymaker.
Yeah.
But both Bob and Gene were supportive. And it went through the curriculum committee and on to the Senate. And Bob Lancelotti and I went to the Senate meeting and answered questions. And that's, of course, when this constitutional question came up. And it was approved at the Senate meeting subject to the resolution of this constitutional question about a separate dean. And that later led to essentially what was a footnote to the proposal that we would operate as we had proposed as an independent unit, but that we would be within the College of Business and Bob Lancelotti would be the dean. Instead of being the common dean, he was lead dean, I guess.
And at this point then, you're getting support from within the college.
Yes.
Nobody's standing up at the Senate saying we oppose this or anything like that.
No. The college did pass it. As a matter of fact, the college meeting, they passed it unanimously. After the school got in place, we started getting the normal kinds of things that would come up. People saying, why are they able to do this and we are not able to do it? Why can they approve their own curriculum? As an example, we changed the degree designation from a Master of Arts degree to a Master of Accountancy degree. And I talked to as part of the proposal, and so when I cleared it, I told Bob Lancelotti and the associate dean of the college at the time that I was ready to submit that, and I submitted it. And a month or two later, when it came back, the college faculty got concerns that why wasn't this not processed through us, you see? And of course, with the school mechanism, the whole idea was we would not have to process that through them. And so we had a lot of things like that happen where people on the faculty who either did not understand what we told them we were going to do or chose not to understand it or reacted differently than they thought they might raised a number of questions, and the dean did as well, as we tried to forge along and try to live up to our agreements. And fortunately, that's mostly been resolved. But it could change again, I suppose, with the personality of a new dean or some other people in there. But at least right now, it's working about the way it was supposed to be.
How much lobbying was needed to get the Regents' approval? Chancellor, I guess, was E.T. York.
E.T. York. Matter of fact, I saw E.T. in Washington, D.C. last week and reminded him that I'd not seen him for a long time, that Doug Thompson and I went up to Tallahassee and met with E.T. York on this before it was ever approved. And
you had to do a strong sell?
No, not really. And of course, as you would expect, E.T. was really he didn't commit much one way or the other. He listened and certainly didn't raise any opposition. And there was some individual lobbying of Board of Regents members to explain to them what we were doing that I was not involved in because I did not know any of the members of the Board of Regents. And I think Bob Lancelotti did do some lobbying. Some of the others, like Al Warrington, did some lobbying. And
for you? For the program?
For the approval of the school, right. And we then, we knew it was scheduled for a Board of Regents meeting in Tampa in April of 77, as I recall. I think it was the month of April of 77. And we started planning a celebration event concurrent, and we sent out notices that we're assuming this does get approved. We had it hedged, basically. I guess we didn't tell people, but we had it hedged, and our plan was, assuming it is approved, we'll go on with the celebration as it is. and celebrate the launch of the School of Accounting. If it does not, if it gets turned down, we'll simply make it a celebration of all this fundraising that took place. Some of it was, of course, geared at the school, but some of it had been very successful apart from that. So we had this event set up, went to the Board of Regents meeting. They approved it, and so it turned into a celebration event to announce the school.
You were covering everything, weren't you? So the big event then was approved.
Yes.
In Tampa.
In Tampa, and we had a dinner that night, and all the members of the Board of Regents attended. Most of our steering committee were there. A good portion of our faculty were there.
Tell me about this business of making it a 6-year experimental program. Why?
The primary reason was because we had gone so far, and we were saying we wanted to operate as a freestanding school. And there's just no way that anyone would have proved that at that point, nor was there enough evidence that that was the way to go, because no one else really had done it. So the only feasible way to go was to make it experimental. And that was also really the only way to get around the constitutional issue. So that became something that became, the experimental notion was there before the constitutional issue came up, but the experimental notion really got firmly put in place as the whole explanation for the mechanism, not just experimenting with a new program, but that's how we're going to operate. To somewhat relate to the constitutional issue.
Now, did this mean at the end of 6 years, you were going to look at the whole program and say whether it was successful or not?
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't, you would then go back to the old system?
Essentially, we had a letter from Bob Bryan saying that at the end of the 6 years, it would be reviewed, and at that time, one of two things would happen. Either a constitutional amendment would be requested to let the school be freestanding as originally proposed, or that would revert back to departmental status. As it turned out, neither one of those two things happened.
Mm-hmm. So the experiment didn't mean that during this time you were innovating and creating new curriculum and doing all of those wonderful things to see whether they would work or not. That would have happened regardless.
Some of those things would have happened, yes. They certainly happened faster. And better, for the most part, with the School of Accounting umbrella, because it created a sharper focal point. Mm-hmm. I think it certainly became a very quick focal point for the students. I think it continued to be a focal point for fundraising. And I think it was a factor in helping the hiring of some faculty, at least.
Did you feel during the early period when all of this was being organized, what the hell am I getting myself into? I had such a pleasant life as just being chairman of a department.
I'm not sure I realized that at the outset. I think I realized that more as I got into it. It certainly used a lot of energy. It created a certain amount of conflict that you would not normally have in administration as you're trying to chart new territory and as you're trying now to live up this freestanding notion with persons who really don't want you to be freestanding. So it certainly, there were times when I wondered what I had gotten myself into. But see, now the other thing too is that we created a lot of attention on the national scene. And so everybody was looking at the University of Florida to try to find out what was going on, because we were the first, we were the highest ranking university to do this first. Missouri is a good university, but does not rank as high as the University of Florida. Not maybe far down the list, but in accounting certainly does not rank as high. BYU has a super accounting program, but they do not have a doctoral program, and I mean, there's some limitations. We were the first of the so-called elite universities to do this.
And so the eyes of the world were on Gainesville.
No doubt about it. I remember making a presentation that I also hadn't helped organize the Federation of Schools of Accountancy, which was going on about the same time, and I was one of the charter participants. And the first 2 or 3 years, we made presentations about our school there. And I remember about the second or third year when I made a presentation, a good friend of mine who had become director of the School of Accounting in Georgia at that point, because they had organized a school just after us, and we were over at the coffee table, and I heard, he did not know I was behind him. I heard him say to somebody else, he said, everybody's still looking at the University of Florida. And that clearly was the case for a while. So we got a lot of national attention, but it also created increased the work effort and involvement. But it probably added a certain amount of excitement to it as well.
What about I mean, go on, tell me a little bit more about Lancelotti's involvement during these very early years.
Well, as I say, we could not have done it without him.
And he was certainly involved in with the fundraising, but from that point on.
And we did run into some problems in the sense that this became such a high-profile thing, and I think he also got, as I mentioned before, he got flagged from other deans. And we had some problems in terms of defining what freestanding really meant and what director meant, and so just in terms of processing things, little things, we had some disputes over what was form and what was substance, and he still wanted to process documents through the Associate Dean of the College, and it seemed to me like freestanding meant that, you know, they should not go detour through there. We had initially this concern about sending some of our proposals through the other part of the college curriculum committee, and it took us a while to straighten that out. We don't do that anymore. I mean, we still are freestanding in that sense. And there just were a number of things that came up. And also then I became president of the Federation of Schools of Accountancy. And I remember one instant where I had to go out and testify against the 150-hour program, which all the deans were really opposed to the 150-hour program. And Bob wrote me kind of a nasty little note and said, don't think you ought to be doing this, something to that effect. And I had to write him back and clearly point out that I was speaking as president of FSA and I would not be speaking for the University of Florida. He said I should disavow my associate at the University of Florida, make clear that I was not speaking for the University of Florida. And I explained to him it would be clear that I was there as president of the Federation of Schools of Accountancy. So I think he started getting pressure from other deans, and so we ran into some problems, definitional kind of things.
Well, I know that Bob is no shrinking violet at all.
That's correct.
And I was wondering if he was not becoming, you know, Simmons is getting a little bit too big for his britches. And the more he grows, it's taking away from me.
I don't know that there was that. I will, in hindsight, think I probably made a political mistake in the sense that there was a lot of attention focused on the school. And, of course, with me as immediate director, that being my interest, people would come to me. And these national presentations, and primarily, you know, they were asking me to do it. I think I made a mistake in not involving Bob more than I did. I do think I made a mistake. I think that Bob, some of the differences that Bob and I had, and we're good friends today. We still respect each other, and I have to give him extreme credit for helping us do this initially. But some of the problems he and I ran into, which ultimately caused me to resign once over a dispute, and then a year or two later, probably still stepped down earlier than I would have otherwise. The tension just got too great. Probably some of that could have been avoided if I had been a little smoother in keeping him involved rather than just doing things on my own.
What was the problem that developed between you and Bob? Was it a matter of curriculum? Or?
It was just several issues over this notion of freestanding. And one of the things that the university had committed...
You defined it differently than he defined it.
That's right. One of the things that was committed was that we would have separate identifiable space. That's a phrase. What does it mean? Well, it meant one thing to me. It meant something else to Bob, apparently. And we got into a real dispute over the building because our alumni persons wanted to see something that was pretty clearly identifiable as a school of accounting. And as we started to evolve the plans for the new building, that wasn't clearly being delineated. And so that plus a number of other issues, I felt like I was in a trusteeship position with these funds that were given to us from outside supporters based upon a freestanding school. And I got to a point at one time where I felt like my role as a trustee in making certain commitments to the supporters that I was caught between, maybe I was getting in an impossible position, so I resigned. And
you did resign?
Yes. And the school accounting faculty immediately met and generated a resolution to Bob asking he not accept the resolution. And then a few days passed, and some of the alumni met. And
what are the dates?
There's actually a copy of the resolution that was passed.
Are we free to include this in the
Well, it's correspondence that I guess is, it's certainly not public, but it's certainly public within the university, so I guess it can be included. The bottom line is we were able to resolve these reasonably well.
Well, that's the important thing, and you're still here,
and the school is
still here.
And that's right,
and
we could not have done it without Bob. On the other hand, I think it would be misleading if we sort of gave the impression that this happened without problems.
But probably that same thing would be true if we were discussing any other aspect of the University of Florida.
I think that's true, and you have to keep in mind that there were deans all over the country who killed this thing and didn't even let it go forward. Mm-hmm. Some big examples like University of Illinois, University of Texas, programs that were leading this effort before us that were not successful in ever bringing it about.
Has not Bob Lancelotti continued to support your fundraising and doing all of these other things over the years?
You'll have to ask Bob, but I believe Bob regards the school with a certain amount of pride. He likes to be involved with us. He likes to be involved with our alumni. He likes to handle the golf outing when our steering committee meets. I think Bob, despite the problems we've had over the years, I think he, like myself, views the accomplishment as being so much more significant. I think when you talk to him, you will find he takes pride in the school of accounting.
It happened on his watch.
That's right. And he did have something to do with it.
I want to ask you about the University Curriculum Committee. What were you presenting to them?
I was a little surprised I had to go through them, but basically the whole proposal went to them, partly because we were changing the degree programs. But the whole proposal, including the proposal for the School of Accounting, went through them. That was the first step before it could go to the Senate.
What is this 150-hour program that you were talking about?
It's almost like two circles. The 150-hour program is one circle. Schools of Accounting is another circle, and the two strongly overlap. You can have one without the other, but it's stronger if you have both of them together. And the movement started about the same time. So we were working within the state of Florida very early on to try to get the state to adopt a 150-hour requirement for accounting majors, because the feeling in the profession was that the knowledge had grown so much that it was impossible to get it within 4 years, and that we needed a 150-hour requirement. So we're working on that at the same time. And that was passed by Florida. Florida was about the second or third state to pass it. Florida was the first state to implement it. And by the time that we organized the School of Accounting, we knew that that was very likely to be a rule in Florida, and so it just strengthened the School of Accounting, simply is what happened.
Now, when a freshman enrolls at the University of Florida and his commitment is to take a degree in the School of Accounting, you control him completely right from day one in terms of his curriculum?
Well, of course, the first 2 years, most of the students will spend in the liberal arts college, and of course they take all the university requirements. Once they get into the School of Accounting, then they do become an AC student. We carry all the file on them, and we are the advisor and the counselor, and we do certify the degree.
How many hours does the student need in order to get into the school the first 2 years?
We basically look at the if they're a transfer student, we basically expect the AA degree, and if it's our own student, it's essentially completion of the first 2 years, and the specified courses. There are the university gen ed requirements, general education requirements, and there are professional courses, and so we look at that. So we basically expect them to have completed essentially the two freshman and sophomore years.
You counsel these students in their freshman year?
No, we do not.
So there's no way for you to say, we want you to take a survey course in U.S. history?
No. We don't actually start officially counseling them, and really, to my knowledge, and I've been away from this now for several years, so you really would need to ask the current administrative people to be precise on this, but I don't think we have any significant informal contact with them until they apply for the School of Accounting.
Is this good or bad?
I think it's good. I mean, it does mean that you need to get information out in other ways, and make people aware of the school, but that seems to have happened pretty naturally on its own. I think that I basically believe in upper division colleges. I think that the first 2 years, and we used to have the old general college here. I'm not sure whether that was, I never did get involved in politics on that. I don't know whether that was a good or a bad idea, but I have no problem with being housed in liberal arts. But I think that, I believe in a professional discipline like engineering or business or law, medicine, a little different. I think basically it ought to be upper division, in some cases postgraduate. Many people now feel accounting ought to be postgraduate.
Do you feel that your accountants need to have some of the humanities courses?
Oh, yes, yes. And that's probably become more important now. It was always important, but the relative importance of it has probably increased today as compared to what it was when it organized the school.
Why?
Because of the complexity of business. And because of the globalization, there certainly is more concern over issues like being able to manage a diversified workforce, even in accounting, or being able to go in and audit persons from a different culture, to understand different cultures, to business decisions, and accounting audit teams are done more and more in teamwork, where you have to work with other people to produce the product. So I would say it's not just in accounting. I mean, accounting and business are tied in many ways, and I'd say for both business and accounting that the notion of work and ethics, work and international related issues, just a greater appreciation of individuals and cultures, that's increased significantly in the last few years.
When you were actually involved in the program as the director, and maybe even since then, have you been disappointed in the quality of the students that have come into you from the community colleges or from the program here at the University of Florida? Can they read? Can they write?
There are several different questions in there. The bottom line is that we get very good students here. Most of our faculty we hired from northern schools, primarily the so-called Big Ten conference schools, because they have been the long-standing prestigious grantors of PhDs in accounting, along with some private schools like Chicago and Stanford. And so we always sort of ask ourselves, and of course I came from Ohio State and Minnesota, we sort of, over the years, have asked ourselves, how do our students compare? And the general feeling has been that the top students are just as good, and we had a bigger tail here, though, of poor students. And basically, in accounting, we've cut off that tail by admission standards, and we just could not take everybody anyway. So it's probably been very good that we could not take everybody. And so we get pretty uniformly good students. Community college transfer is always a problem. It was a problem in Minnesota when I was there. It's a problem with every university I talked to, and that it's a cultural shock for them when they get to a university like the University of Florida. And we have much higher failure rate in community college transfers, and I think that's not unique to us. That's true everywhere. Doesn't mean that community college is doing a bad job. It's just that it's a little different culture, and maybe you get different students going there. I don't know what all the reasons are, but it's always a cultural shock and always a transition problem, and particularly when they go into accounting, which is one of the tougher disciplines on campus. So we have problems with that. We have problems with that all over the country. The other thing we saw at the University of Florida when various of us came in over the years is that it's maybe a little harder to get the students, took a little more effort to get the students to work hard. I think that the work ethic now is so well known in the School of Accounting that maybe students know for the most part coming in that what's expected of them. But still, you find more students running off the beach on a Friday here than you did, say, at Minnesota, where there was no beach to go to.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of a problem. I think it holds University of Florida back a little bit. I think that this is an excellent institution. I think the students are good. I think they work reasonably hard. I think that the work ethic maybe not as strong, at least, as some of us have seen at other universities.
As a freestanding school, who hires the faculty of accounting?
We basically make our own faculty decision. Now, we're no longer a freestanding school. At the end of the six-year experimental period, as I mentioned, neither the freestanding nor reverting back to department happened as the letter from Bob Bryan to Al Warrington indicated would be the case. And so what we essentially did was we reached a compromise situation where we would be a school within the College of Business with certain guaranteed autonomies. And so we maintain our curriculum autonomy. We control our own curriculum, our own degree programs. We maintain a separate budget autonomy. We do not share the budget with the college except on some common things like computers and libraries.
Does this mean in the budget that you prepare your budget, you submit it as though you were a college?
And the dean has to really wear two hats. He will go generally the way it's supposed to work, and the way I understand it is working now is that the dean will go over with the associate dean of the college. And, well, one of the compromises we made when we became a school within the college on a permanent basis is there are two associate deans, the associate dean and director for the School of Accounting, the associate dean for the College of Business. And basically what is supposed to happen, and what I understand does happen, is that the dean essentially has two hearings with Gene Hemp and or the provost. And where's two hats?
So you're allocated X number of dollars, and then you can spend those dollars as you see fit?
That's correct.
Yeah. So you do not need to go beyond that. Obviously, the dean may have to sign off on these things. Mm-hmm. So does this mean the director then is responsible for hiring his faculty?
Yes, although the dean certainly is the dean of the school as well.
Oh, yeah, I understand
and
that.
And so
yeah.
The dean gets involved too. And that'll vary a little bit with the dean. Even with Bob Lanzalotta, even before we became a school, at that time we had pretty strong department chairman, and most of the time the department chairman were making the offers. I always made the offer. I always decided how much to offer and wrote the letter. In some later years, that was done by the dean, and I think today it's done by the dean, actually. I think the dean actually may write the offer letter.
Do you have a situation where you share faculty? A person who is in the School of Accounting might also be teaching economics or something else?
No, well, there are no joint appointments. From time to time, it's been talked about whether it was some sort of a shared interest, but there are not any actual joint appointments per se right now. And going back to the autonomies, to clarify today's situation, we originally started a freestanding school, and then at the end of the 6-year experimental period, we were placed in the college on a permanent basis with a Senate document, basically, that gave it certain autonomies, and that did create autonomy over curriculum, autonomy over budget, and the one place that's become fuzzy, where we were separate and we're not very separate anymore, is on promotion and tenure. That does now run through a college committee and onto the personnel committee. The compromise there that we are supposed to be able to file our own, and we do file our own promotion and tenure criteria, but they have to be consistent with the college as well as the university. So in terms of a freestanding school, one of the things we probably have lost in that sense that we did have at one time was promotion and tenure autonomy. Most of the other things are intact, and we really do operate as a freestanding school.
How do your salaries compare with the college?
The market sets that more than anything else, and accounting traditionally has been the highest. In the last few years, I think finance probably may on a national average actually have passed. I'm talking about starting salaries because those are the easiest things to tell. Mm-hmm. Starting salaries have always been higher in accounting the entire time I've been here, with the exception, I think, finance in the last 2 or 3 years has caught up or may, in fact, actually have passed accounting very slightly. In terms of across the ranks, I don't know. We don't really keep up with it that well.
Is that a problem for you in accounting as compared with business?
No, and a business course would have the same problem with many other disciplines on campus.
I mean, we in the history department are very unhappy with the salaries over in accounting and law and medicine. Mm-hmm. But what else is new?
Right. I mean, and to some extent, we've had the same thing in accounting within the college, but not
that's
too much.
I mean, yeah.
You certainly have a hierarchy where accounting has been the highest, maybe finance is now, economics probably the lowest, and it can create some problems. But right now, it's so overshadowed by the fact that everybody's unhappy with their salaries. So
including the history department faculty.
So, So I think that if there is unhappiness, it's directed at the state and rather than any individual unit.
John, explain to me the difference between the four-year program and the five-year program.
The basic difference is what you can do in the senior year. If we look at a five-year program, you can think of about a 4-1 or a 3-2. And the 150-hour notion is that you really need to have the students for 2 years in a graduate setting. And it's not considered politically expedient or practical. And some people maybe even might think it's not desirable to go, say, a 4-2. Now, it may eventually evolve to a 4-2, but much like the law school evolved. But the thing that was settled on as being the best program for now for accounting is a 150-hour program, and this is basically a national decision. Not everybody agrees with it, even in accounting, but it's a national decision. And half the states now have adopted it, right at half the states. Mm-hmm. But the real difference is you can do some different things in 2 years. Then, so that if you have a senior year, you're not going to do much different in the junior year. But in the senior year, if you know they're basically graduate students and they're going on for the fifth year, there are different things you can do than if they're just going to quit at the end of 4 years. And that's there are other differences, but that is the most telling difference in, I think, the eyes of people who support the 150-hour program. Obviously, it starts out the notion that you need 5 years of work. But the 150-hour program then has been talked about, rather than saying a graduate degree, it's been talked about 150 hours because of the political climate that you probably cannot require a graduate degree and get away with it. There are minority questions. There are lots of four-year schools around. And so basically what people have settled on is 150-hour requirement. For most schools, that's going to be a graduate degree. The ideal way to get it is probably not a 4-1, but a 3-2. And that's what we do here.
Did you institute a placement program from the very beginning?
No, we've always used university placement. We certainly have, but we have something called Beta Alpha Psi, which is our accounting organization that has recruiters come in and present meetings and their, you know, receptions and cocktail parties. So there's a lot of recruiting that goes on, mm-hmm. specific in accounting. But in terms of the official recruiting, we've always relied on the university.
Have you been successful in placing your graduates and ranking?
Very. The recruiters clearly tell us that our students are the best in the state and among the best in the country. We're in a very high level with all the firms in terms of relative numbers they hire here. The market's been tight the last couple of years, and for the last 2 years, not all of our good students have been placed, and that's the first time that we've seen that. And that's a function of the market.
What about University of Florida graduates holding faculty positions elsewhere?
I mean, like PhDs that we grant?
I mean, where are they around? Do you have any deans, any school directors?
No deans or directors.
Any superstars?
There are some. The two things that came the slowest at the school, it took longer for the research to develop, it took longer for the PhD program to gain the strength that it should. Those just, as you know, just take longer to do. We could put the curriculum in place, we could raise admission standards, we get the good students in place pretty fast, we got the faculty in place pretty fast. The thing that took the longest was to get the research program up, and we're now pretty consistently ranked about 14th in the country in terms of publications, citations, which is much higher than we were before. And our PhD program is a lot better than it used to be. But we do not have the history. We're relatively weaker there than we would be in terms of our view of our overall accounting program. Even though our PhD program now is fully accepted and viewed very highly, and our good students can go anywhere, Texas, Illinois, Michigan, anywhere, that's been a little bit harder to come by, a little more recent. So, because it's been more recent, we don't probably have as many superstars out there as a Michigan or an Illinois or Texas would be, where they had their PhD program in place.
What are the other major programs in the South that would compare with Florida's?
The obviously I'm biased. I don't think there is an accounting program in the South until you get out to the University of Texas that most people do consider to be at the same level as ours, although the gap may not be great. But I think that Georgia and Florida State, certainly North Carolina institution is highly regarded. The accounting program has been a little bit down, but it's coming back. I'd say in terms of an institution, people view, and PhD programs, people view accounting at North Carolina to be a more comparable place in the South. In terms of overall accounting programs, probably the ones would be Georgia and Florida State, Tennessee. But I don't think there's anyone that views any of those to be quite the same level we are.
Nationally, are we in the top 10?
By most surveys, we have been in the top 10, particularly with our master's program. The surveys tend to look at some things like research, where we've been about 14th. They tend to look at undergraduate programs and master's programs. We've been as high as 4th or 5th in our master's program nationwide. Undergraduate program is usually a couple notches below that. But yes, we've generally been in the top 10.
What was the approximate enrollment in accounting when it started in 77? Less than 1,000.
Yes, we've maintained our enrollment pretty consistently. As a matter of fact, in the last couple of years, we've tried to reduce it a little bit. But it's generally been right around 600 in total would be a pretty good figure. It's maybe gotten up to 700 or 800, maybe down to 500. And we've been pretty consistently around 600, 700. The thing that has changed is that we have fewer undergraduates and more masters. Our master's program now has about 190 people in it. And that was virtually like 3 or 4 people when I came down here. So we've tried to keep our numbers about the same, but what's happened is we have a higher proportion of graduate students and a lower proportion, relatively, of undergrad students as compared to when the school was first started.
When did you leave as director?
1980.
Why?
Oh, it somewhat was burnout, somewhat tension between Bob and I. As I say again, we have a good long-term relationship, but I felt like that the school would probably be better off at that point to get somebody new in and continue with it from there.
And so what did you do?
I moved into a chaired position, the Pete Marwick Professorship, which was not terribly important one way or the other. But what did happen and what had already happened, and probably the thing that there are two things that really kept me here. One, rather than going off and particularly being in administration somewhere else, one was simply my vested interest in school. In some ways, I still view it as a child, so to speak.
You were the godfather.
I mean, I'm not sure what the right term is, but I think probably school still means more to me than perhaps to anybody else on our faculty, though it certainly means a lot to a number of people. But that kept me here. And the fact that I felt like I could still contribute something to the school and helping it progress. The other thing that also kept me satisfied is I got involved very quickly at the national level and things like being on the Board of Examiners that administers the national examination and being involved as an officer in the American Accounting Association and just a variety of things like that that I've been involved in and still am today that sort of satisfied, I guess, whatever one needs to satisfy in terms of ego feedback and things like that.
And so when you took over the chair, was the salary okay?
Yes, the... it's not like some I've heard on campus where you take a 12-month salary and convert it to 9. I did get a cut.
End of tape A, side 2. The interview continues with tape B, side 1.
Do as well then as...
No, salary is not what's kept me here. It's been other things.
Has your health been good here?
Yes.
So you have not regretted it then. What do you do as a professor?
I teach full time most of the time. When I was president-elect and president of the American Accounting Association, I did not. But I teach primarily graduate courses.
Did you teach when you were the director?
We have a rule basically the administrator has to teach one course a year. And I did that.
What do you teach now?
I teach mainly graduate course in financial accounting. I'm teaching accounting theory to our master's student this year. Last year I taught a course called Advanced Accounting, which is primarily the consolidations and issues and the cases of accounting.
So how many hours are you in the classroom?
Normal load is two courses each term, and those are generally three-hour courses.
Are you still able to do research?
No, I still mostly substitute policy involvement at the national level. For example, the most recent thing I just went on is the, I just was in Washington, D.C. last week and got an update on GATT and NAFTA, because both GATT and NAFTA have provisions in them that include accounting services. And so we're putting together an international qualifications board to look at reciprocal qualifications in other countries. And they have worked it out with Canada before I got on the board. But now we have to work it out with potentially Mexico and 35 countries in GATT. And so I still stay. That really takes most of my outside time.
I wanted to ask you about this Accounting Research Center. What is it?
The Accounting Research Center was organized initially to try to serve as a catalyst to raise the level of faculty research. And I'm not sure, this is not on, oh, I sit on, I guess. And one of the things that was a little bit lower level performance than one would like when I came was accounting research. And I thought there were some research centers around, and we didn't have one. And in looking at that mechanism, I thought that an accounting research center would serve as a focal point for, if we could get the right person in there, that would serve as a catalyst to elevate the research a little bit faster. And so we organized the Accounting Research Center, and Rashad Abdelkhalik, the graduate research professor, really developed it. He was the second person in, because the first person only stayed a year, but he was the second person into that job, and he's the one that really developed it. And it did serve as a catalyst. They also did some conferences and started a journal in accounting, which we still do today. And the research center then went through a period of inactivity of about, I forget exactly when this happened, maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago, went into a period of inactivity. And we're just now bringing it back off the shelf. It was very active from 77 through, I don't know, 85 or 6. And then it went into a period of inactivity. And we're just now bringing it back off the shelf. And it's going to be more, it's going to be more active in terms of doing that same thing. And sort of the catalyst for faculty research, sponsoring some conferences, continuing with this journal.
Who is the person that only stayed 1 year?
Fellow named Russ Barefield.
Russell
Barefield.
How do you spell his last name?
Barefield.
He came from where?
From University of Arizona.
And where'd he go?
Went back to Arizona. He was only here a few months and decided that he really missed Arizona, wanted to go back to Arizona. And so he was here maybe 9 months, but within 3 or 4 months, we knew he was going to be leaving.
And his successor?
Is Rashad Abdelkhalik.
Would you spell that?
A-B-D-E-L. Well, he goes by Rashad, R-A-S-H-A-D. And A-B-D-E-L dash little K-H-A-L-I-K.
And where's he from?
We hired him from Duke. And that's where
he was. Sounds like he's an Indian, though.
Egyptian. Now, Rashad is no longer the director of the research center. He basically stepped out of that position when he became editor of the Accounting Review, which is our number one publication in accounting, academic publication. And so that's in part when the research center became more inactive. And now we have a new director just been appointed.
Who is that?
A fellow named Robert Neckel.
Neckel?
Neckel, K-N-E-C-H-E-L. He's just come up to the ranks and is ready to take on those kind of responsibilities. But at any rate, the research center was set up basically for 3 or 4 things. As I say, one of them was to be a catalyst. The main thing is to be a catalyst to help faculty. Rashad was brought in as a catalyst, and he was told initially that one of his responsibilities would be to critique and read other papers, involve faculty in projects and things like that. And that worked. He certainly was Rashad, more than anybody, was a big factor in elevating our research and our doctoral program.
Did that depend upon outside funding?
Yes, yeah. We had no funding from the state initially. We set up solely with our own enrichment funding. Later, the state took over some small funding, some secretarial help, some summer support, I think, for the director. But it initially was funded solely from the outside and still will be funded some from the outside.
So does the school do an annual fundraising thing for its enrichment program?
Yes, yeah, we still do. We do not go out and secure funds for the School of Accounting organizational effort anymore. And of course, we have the Fisher funds also, but there still is an annual enrichment fund drive that.
So the director is out there massaging.
Yes, no doubt about it, and has to work with the people involved. It somewhat runs itself in the sense that these are campaigns primarily that the firms put on, and somebody in the firm usually directs it. But sure, the director, the school administrator, still has to encourage these people and work with them. And
you were able to increase it from 10,000 to 50,000 in 1 year. Where is it today?
More than that. I could not tell you the figure offhand because when we get the reports and look at them, we also get obviously focused on the Fisher funds as well, which are much even bigger. So I would have to guess. You would have to ask Doug Snowball. My guess would be that it must be it's more than 50. My guess would be, well, one thing we didn't have any chairs at the time, but see, now we get, it's more complex now. It's kind of hard to separate because we have several chaired professorships. We had none when I came, and now we have the Pete Marwick one, which I'm in. We have
Is
Arthur
that
Anderson.
The first one?
That was the first one, and Arthur Anderson and Ernst & Whinney and Deloitte Touche. We have at least four or five chairs.
Don't tell me you didn't get a Ben Hill Griffin.
No, these are all CPA firms. And as a matter of fact, when I brought in Russ Bierfield for the first research center director and then subsequently Rashad, I had to bring them in as a Matherly professor, which was the only mechanism we had for a chaired professor at the time. And we had to provide our own funding. All we had was a title. And so both of those individuals brought into what we had called a Matherly professorship. I don't think anyone's using those anymore, which was simply a title. We provided the funding. Of course, it was later then that Rashad became a graduate research professor. But at any rate, to go back, I sort of sidestepped your question. So the funding now, you see, we have the Fisher funds, we have these chaired professorships, we have the unrestricted funds, and they sort of all get lumped together. And I could not tell you offhand what would be precisely the amount of sort of the unrestricted enrichment funding. You'd have to ask Doug Snowball.
I want to talk to you about Fred Fisher. How did he come aboard?
Fred's a little more recent, and there are probably other persons who can tell you better than I. But it basically came from someone in the foundation, a contact, that approached Fred. And Fred had a particular interest in the School of Accounting. As I understand it, and this came after me, so I was not directly involved in it, but I understand it, that was not so much one of us out there looking for as it was, in fact, the foundation doing what it's supposed to do, and that's finding someone that was interested in us.
And Fred was interested.
And Fred was interested in us. And he is an ideal person to
make. It's been a wonderful marriage, though, hasn't it?
It's been a great marriage. Fred is, not only is he a great person to have the school named after, but he's alive. And he interacts with us and he shows up.
And he's smart.
Yes. So if you were to go out and try to find somebody to name the school after, you could not find somebody than Fred, but more than better than Fred Fisher. Now, if you're trying to find somebody who maybe deserved it more than anyone else, Al Warrington clearly, in terms of input to the school.
He just didn't have the $6 million.
That's right. There's nobody in Al's category in terms of effect on the school, particularly in his early crucial years. But in terms of just finding somebody that you would like to have the school named after, Fred is an ideal person.
Y'all haven't named anything within the building itself after Al?
No. We have named Al as one of our distinguished alumni. Al was the first, as you might expect, when we started this. And Bob Ellison and Fred Edenfield have all been named. They were all among the first two or three people to be named. Doug Thompson has been named. So almost all of the people who were highly involved with us, but it wasn't just involvement. They had to have achieved outside. And see, all of those had achieved significant things other than involvement with us, and so it took a combination to be named as a distinguished.
Now, these are distinguished alumnus within the college?
Within the Fisher School of Accounting.
Within the Fisher School, not distinguished alumnus for the University of
Florida. No, and I'm not sure whether any of them are so named or not. Some of them certainly deserve it, but no, this particular one I'm referring to is we started this within the School of Accounting, and we generally most often announce one a year.
I started to ask you before, and I'm not sure we got that answer completely. I was asking you for superstars. Are there any accounting gators chairing departments and serving as deans outside of...
No, well, there is one who, again, what happened was that our PhD program was more of a regional program, I think, than anything else in terms of looking to people that were here in the past. But and so our fast-tracking people have been fairly recent and have not been out there a long time. There is one very clear superstar that came here and went through the PhD program in 2 years, a female who has had a very fast track and is currently an associate dean at William & Mary and has held some chaired positions, a very big chaired position at Texas A&M was her last position before this one. She's decided she wants to get in administration. She holds both a chair and the associate deanship at William & Mary.
Who is she?
Her name is Wanda Wallace. And she clearly is a superstar.
What about in government?
No, our superstars have been more in public accounting, where you might expect them to end up, but not at the PhD level. As I say, we've got faculty in key positions at major universities like Texas and Illinois and University of Southern California, places like that. But in terms of them having either become like an equivalent of graduate research professor or something like that, the only one I can think of offhand is Wanda Wallace. In terms of graduates of the program, we have several very prominent people. We have the head of one of the big six firms, Mike Cook. We have a person who's probably, and this is, it's comparable to being chairman of a very large corporation. We have a graduate who's CEO of Northwest Airlines. We have someone who's about second or third in command, about is in charge of the international part of the accounting firm with another firm. So we have some very high-ranking
individuals,
and then again, this is not direct answer to PhDs because I say we've got some very good PhDs. I cannot identify too many really superstars out there because again, most of the really good PhDs have been turned out since about 1980. So that's not a very long time span.
John, one of the areas that I'd like to explore a bit with you has to do with ethics. That's a rising area of concern throughout universities, not just our university. Where does this fit into the accounting curriculum?
There are two kinds of ethics in accounting. One is the professional code of ethics, which is deals more with how you behave as an auditor, and deals more with things like independence with respect to a client, so things like that. The issue that's received more attention, I think, recently has been the general ethics question.
That's really what I'm asking about.
And the profession as a whole has done more than we have. Arthur Anders, for example, has done a lot of work in putting out cases and videos that people can use in teaching ethics. The American Accounting Association that I was president of 3 years ago organized a series of symposiums on ethics and developed some cases and some videos, and I went to two of the symposiums. So there's been a lot done. Now, we're still struggling with what to do at the University of Florida. I have taught an ethics segment in one of the courses I teach. Others teach ethics cases from time to time in courses they teach. We do not have a very systematic approach to teaching the general ethics right now. The code of ethics, professional ethics, is covered in one of our courses for auditors. But the general ethics is an area that not only the school, but the whole college is working on. And it's an area that we probably are not doing as much as we should.
What was your involvement in the construction of the building?
I was director of the school at the time we approved the plans and was involved in discussions on the plans, and that's one reason I got into a dispute with Bob Lanzalotti in terms of how separate the county facilities would be identified. And so one of the things that happened then is we agreed that the School of Accounting complex offices would basically be on one side of the building. You'd go up the main entrance, the School of Accounting complex would be on the one side, and the College of Business Administrative Office would be on the other side. And so it's very much parallel. And I basically designed the administrative space for accounting. In a sense, I didn't design it, but I approved it and said, you know, move this line here and move that office there and that sort of thing. So it's been redone since then, but basically I was involved in creating our space needs and approving the design of our space needs.
Is that space thrown into the pool, the room allocation pool for classrooms?
No, the classroom space. We did in the building did not. The building only has 4 auditorium kinds of classrooms, so there was not much classroom space in the new.
So you didn't have to.
And we got one of those. We have control over one of those rooms. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The college business, of which you're part of, but I mean the rest of the college of business has control over the other 3.
Do you have any space in Bryan Hall?
No, not that's officially designated. And this is one place where we are, where our reputation seeds our actual quality. Our space situation is poor. Our classroom situation is poor. One of the things that helped us get that new building is we took Al Warrington, other alumni, through the old library stacks in Bryan, where we had some of our faculty housed years ago. And that was all part of this discussion about creating a school and getting our own space, and that helped get the new building. But the one thing that we've never been able to do, be very successful on, is classroom space. And we're working on that now. As a matter of fact, Doug has given a proposal to the central administration to try to get us some classroom space that we can design to use computers in, interactive with between the instructor and the students, and there are places that have done that. University of Southern California is probably the best example of a school of accounting that has maybe pulled it off in terms of some of these things better than we have. They have a dean that does report to the dean of the College of Business, but he's also a dean. Of course, it's a private school, USC, and so they have a dean of school of accounting. That's not the important thing. The important thing is they have their own building. And with their own building, old building, they've been able to do a number of things that classroom-wise and library-wise, things like that we've not been able to do.
Do you need, does the building need to be expanded?
We need facilities that are not in that building. We need a professional reading room for our master's students. We need computerized classrooms where they can do interactive kinds of things. Our classrooms just are terrible. It's not just us. It's College of Business. All the classrooms are really bad. And a lot of the classrooms on this campus are not good, but there are some areas that have good classrooms. We have third-rate classrooms. There's no doubt about it. And that's not true just in accounting. It's true in college.
The school doesn't have its own library, does it?
No, it does not. We maintain.
Does it need it?
It would help. It certainly is something that... And it's one of the things I tried to do when I became director of the school. For a while, there was a reading room over in Bryan before it was remodeled that was staffed by the main library, but was designated as a reading room. And we took a corner of that and put things up there that were professional in nature that the library wouldn't normally have over in the main library, and students could go up and check out and read through a professional magazine. And we kept references up there for master students to use, and we operated that for 2-3 years, and then that became a little costly and a little awkward, and we dropped that, and we've never replaced it. We do need a separate professional facility, reading room kind of facility for accounting students, and some programs have it.
As director, what did you do to try to relate the faculty to the students?
Probably the most tangible thing we did was to make, it wasn't so much the faculty and the students. It was the students becoming, being able to have better contact with the profession. Sort of an interesting little story is the first meeting I went to with a CPA firm. And when the CPA firms come on campus from time to time, they get together the faculty so we can have get to know them better and have an exchange of ideas. And Bob Lancelotti and I were both at this meeting, and this particular firm recruiter, very first meeting I'd gone to, almost just arrived here, cornered Bob and I and said something to the effect that we're not very happy with Florida students. They're smart, but they don't know anything about the profession, and they aren't very good at things like interviewing. I don't remember the whole assortment of things, but basically noticing that our students, while maybe sort of intellectually sound, were just not with it in total. And they went on and said we'd much rather hire from Florida State.
Kind of socially inept.
Some of that, yes. We'd much rather hire from Florida State. Those students up there, they've taken the time to learn about the profession. The program teaches them about the profession. They know what they're getting into. They know how to dress. They know how to interview. And again, I don't remember the entire assortment of things, but along those lines. And so one of the first things I did was to try to change our Beta Alpha Psi program, which is an evening program that brings in speakers. And the faculty go to that some, but it's mainly for interaction between the profession and students. And we still, to this day, have a very active professional program, and I think it's helped. Faculty and students, we encourage students, the faculty, to participate in things like that. But I cannot say that outside of the classroom we've done anything specifically to try to increase the bond between faculty and students. There are things we've done, though, with the students, like they formed their own council when we became a school. The students themselves lobbied to get the accounting tassel at graduation to be separate from the College of Business. College has a drab gray or something like that, and accounting, if I remember right, is aqua. And so the students themselves, I think, have generated, and they hang around more, I think, because they identify with the school and they are AC students, and certainly there's that much stronger linkage there. So I suppose that's certainly a part of it.
Do you have a dress code?
No.
So they can come looking just like students elsewhere on the campus.
That's right.
Do you insist on anything with the faculty?
No. We do a lot of times with student presentations in classrooms, and this is happening with increasing frequency, particularly at the graduate level. We usually require professional dress, but it's up to the individual faculty member. But we usually require professional dress for a student group that might be, or an individual student that might be making a presentation. And the Beta Alpha Psi meetings often require professional dress to get the students used to that sort of thing.
And I was thinking that your building and your classes might be more public, more visible than some other parts of the campus to alumni and to representatives of accounting firms. So I was just wondering to what degree you encourage your students to present the proper image.
Well, again, we try to do it when they're going to be on campus, and if there's a Beta Alpha Psi program that's bringing somebody in, usually that will indicate that is professional attire required, is the word that's used. And again, we do it sometimes with presentation of the class. But as far as the faculty on a day-to-day basis, the students on a day-to-day basis, there's no requirement. We try to make sure the students understand what professional dress is by those exposures I just mentioned, but there's no day-to-day code either.
I was just wondering, in view of the complaint that you and Bob had gotten about the students, whether you came back and said, this is what we're going to do now here.
No, we did not go that far. But we did make sure the students were exposed to the Beta Alpha Psi program. They actually even have some programs like, what do you do in a recruiting session and topics like that. So.
Now, we've been talking a lot about Bob Lancelotti. What about his two successors? How did Alan Merton treat accounting in the school?
Alan, of course, was only here either 2 or 3 years, I forget the exact number, and we did not get into many issues. The process was pretty much in place, and we did not get into many issues that surfaced when Alan was here, so I don't know that we had much of a reading one way or the other. John Kraft.
John was here before and John then came was, back.
John was not here when the school was developed. He came here. He was here before. He was gone. He came back after the school was in place. Right. And when he was associate dean, again, things were pretty well entrenched. And then John went out to the University of Arizona State, where they have a professional school of accounting, and got some more experience with the school of accounting there. John has been very supportive. John accepts the mechanism, and he wears the two different hats when he goes over for the budget hearing, and he allows us to live up to our agreements in terms of the curriculum and all those kinds of things that are that we're supposed to do separately, and he's been very supportive in that sense.
So you consider him a strong friend in Gort?
Yes, I would say that's a fair assessment. Again, the one thing we've lost is our promotion and tenure autonomy, and John doesn't is not inclined to do anything to correct that or change that, I don't think. But I think there's no doubt about what John is a he's a friend and supporter.
How large is the faculty?
We're supposed to be 25, which was the agreement when we became a school. We're actually down to about 21 or 22.
Were you responsible for Doug Snowball's?
Yes, Doug was the individual. As a matter of fact, I mentioned earlier as we were talking that he interviewed at a time when I could not be down here, so I had him fly through Minneapolis, and Doug and I talked. I interviewed him at the airport in Minneapolis while I was still in the faculty at the University of Minnesota. And subsequently made him an offer, which he accepted.
I thought with that accent that you had gone all the way to London.
No, it's interesting. One time when Doug was still in Seattle and I was still in Minneapolis, I had the occasion to call him for some reason, and I asked for Doug Snowball, and the operator just broke up when I said the name Snowball. I don't know why that tickled her so much. But Doug was one of the first four people I hired.
All right, now we're looking back. This is 1993. You arrived in 1974. You've been here almost 20 years.
Almost.
That's a long segment of your life. What do you want to say about it?
As I said before, it's been a good segment. It's not been without its frustrations.
Did it turn your hair gray?
It certainly turned while I was here and probably was accelerated a little bit by being involved in taking the department from a department to a school, but it's been a valuable experience. I've enjoyed it. It's been good for me as well as the university, I think. And a couple of other interesting things I've been able to do, like I was served on the board, the athletic board for a couple of years. So there were a few side things that were kind of interesting too. But no, to see the school develop the way it has, even though there have been times of frustrations and still to this day, things like the physical facilities are a frustration. Why it's been an experience that not many people get to have. And talking to people today who have an interest in administration, there are not many opportunities that exist like I had when I came here, where there are a lot of faculty vacancies. There was a strong alumni group just itching for something to happen and willing to pitch in and help. And the university was pretty flexible because it was not so had strong traditions, but not so entrenched as in Minnesota or in Illinois or someplace like that, where faculty were afraid to try anything new or different. The foundation was even more flexible at the time, so you could do more different things with less red tape. And it was just everything was right. And not many people have the opportunity to experience something like that, which you think probably is going to have a lasting impact. And so, I mean, it's been a wonderful experience.
Are you involved in policy making in the college, in the school?
Yeah, certainly not like I was when I was the director of the school, but I've been involved in most of our key policy committees. And over time, that's maintained pretty consistently. I would expect now in the years ahead that younger people will carry more of the burden. And they have been in any sense, but I suspect there will be more key policy committees I may not be on. But in the past, I think I've continued to play a big role.
Is the John Simmons that I'm talking to today in 1993 the same John Simmons that arrived here in 1974?
No, we all change. I certainly One thing I have learned is that change does not come as quickly as you would like it to. I've become more patient. Maybe a little wiser. I think that in the sense, though, that I'm an advocate for change if it's necessary and not tied up in status quo is a characteristic that I'm not sure I knew I had when I came here, but I've certainly been aware of as being consistent since then. And if anything has marked my career over this period of time, it's being involved in change, like the School of Accounting, the 150-hour program. I was involved in creating the Accounting Education Change Commission, which is now involved in changing the content of accounting education. And I found that to be very rewarding. Maybe that is different now. Maybe that just grew. Maybe that developed as I, maybe I did not have that when I came. But I still believe that it's important to change when change is needed.
John, what do you do with your time now? I know, you know, beyond the classroom and working with your students.
Well, up until last year, I was very much tied to the American Accounting Association, and this year I'm still chairing the nominating committee. Matter of fact, at the end of this week, I go down to Orlando and schedule it down there.
Speak a little bit about your professional activities beyond the school itself.
About the time I stepped out of administration, I started in a series of things at the national level that included what's called the CPA Exam Review Board, which is a committee of the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy. And I was on that committee for 3 years and chaired it. I continued to be active for a while.
What did you do as chair of that board?
That board is responsible for conducting basically an audit of the administration, the CPA exam, but not just administration, the preparation, administration, and grading the CPA exams. I actually went around to some states, audited, as did the rest of the committee members, audited how the states were doing it. And we audited the people that prepared the exam and the people that graded the exam and just followed all functions. And that board, of course, still exists today. So I was on that 3 years and chaired it. That was a very time-consuming function. At the same time, I was still active in the Federation of School of Accountancy, which I'd helped organize. And then about 1981 or two, I started diminishing my involvement in that after I stepped out of administration. About the time the review board started winding down, I went on the board of directors, or the board of examiners, the ICPA, and served on three subcommittees there. One committee was prepares the practice part of the CPA exam, the other was a grading subcommittee, and I was on the task force that studied the CPA exam and recognized and proposed some big changes in the CPA exam that will now be implemented in 1994. It was another area of change I was involved in. And then I'd always been involved in the American Accounting Association, so about the time the Board of Examiners stuff started winding down. Well, the last thing I did with them was a practice analysis. I chaired a committee that helped design and hire the people to do a practice analysis, and that was an analysis of CPA practice to use to validate the exam. And so then I had to step off of that because I became president-elect of the American Accounting Association, and which is virtually a full-time job. And as president-elect, you appoint several hundred people to committees and set up a budget, and then you follow and make several presentations, and as president, you follow and go to all the activities and speak and so forth. And I only taught half time and really basically one or two courses a year while I was doing that 2 year time period. And that took us up until last year. And really, it was only last year that I could return to full time teaching and feel like I could devote substantially all of my attention to full time teaching. And that's been true really for the last 2 years. I've been more involved with internal things, trying to chair the committee to change our own curriculum within the School of Accounting. We're going through significant curriculum revisions, at least we're talking about what we might do. And some university committees and some college committees. So in the last year or two, what's happened since I got out of administration is I have very significant involvement in outside activities. And then in the last year or two, I've turned more back towards internal university activities, and so that the main outside activity involved in now is this International Qualifications Board that's just getting started to appraise qualifications of CPAs from other countries to be able to practice here in the United States. And so that's my main outside activity. So It's been busy. It's really been something that when one activity starts to wind down, something else seems to pop up to take its place. And so, since I've been out of administration, probably my key contribution has been involvement at the national level in terms of policy kinds of issues.
What about the non-professional John Simmons? What do you do? You read, you hunt, you fish, you travel?
I like to read, but my main activity is sailing. And one of the things I've been able to do in the last couple of years, again, last 2 years, is I've been able to get a little more time together, is take my sailboat down the Bahamas for 6 weeks 2 years ago and maxed out at 2 months last year. We were down there for 2 months.
So that's a fun thing for you.
That's my main relaxation activity, and it's mainly done in the summer.
You travel?
Travel quite a bit in terms of these professional activities, yeah. Just a lot. It's been a little less, again, the last couple of years, but extensive travel, and you have to have an understanding why. Sometimes she could go with me, more often she could not.
Both domestic and foreign?
Not extensively foreign. We had one meeting in Amsterdam with the European accountants while I was president of the American Accounting Association that we went to. And this April, I'm going to go with the European Accounting Association meeting in Finland and also give a talk in Norway and possibly also a talk in, possibly two different separate presentations at two different universities. One scheduled for sure, the other one's still in the talking stage. But give at least one presentation in Norway, attend the European Accounting Association meeting in late April and May, right after classes are out.
What do you see as the future for the school?
I think the school is a dominant school. It has a high reputation. I think we need to increase that. I think that we need to try to stay on the cutting edge, and that's why we're looking at curriculum changes. We need to get better physical facilities, and I think the school will be fine. I think it's very highly regarded, and our basic notion now is to make sure we don't get too comfortable and sit.
Mm-hmm.
Many programs have done that. I could point to several major universities around the country that were on top of the reputation. Michigan was the number one accounting program without doubt for a period of years, and then went through a period of time where they sort of did nothing and really regressed and then had to come back. There's some others around the country you could point to like that, and we need to make sure we don't do that. We need to make sure we continue to grow and get better rather than to sit and be comfortable.
Are dollars the key to all of this?
We need to get some state dollars back, like many units on campus. What's happened is that the university, because we have Fisher funds and other enrichment funds, they have, when those funds are raised, there was a pledge that they would not use those funds to trade off against state funds.
The lottery.
Just like the lottery. That's exactly that's right. And what's happened is that we've been penalized a little bit more. And the only thing that's been able to allow us to keep any degree of national excellence has been the outside funding, particularly the Fisher funds. And we can't do that forever. We've got to get our better funding base back, and we've got to get some better physical facilities. But I think the featured school is bright. I think it's, we're still a little fragile in the sense that we're still kind of a new kid on the block, but I think our reputation has been there long enough now and solid enough that we're reasonably safe.
You see a bright future for the PhD program?
Yes, and like I say, it's grown now, and our people can go, our good people in the program go about any place they want to. The market's tightened up, like it has probably in other fields as well. As a matter of fact, been a freeze, of course, on hiring many places over the last year or two, so that the market has not been great. But PhD program's about where it needs to be.
John, what have we not talked about that we need to get on the record?
Well, I think we covered most of the issues. There may be things that we think about as we think about back about a little bit what we have talked about, but I think we've covered most of it. Again, the school continues to be, we will have more competition. For example, in 74 when I came down here, virtually all of the key people in the state in accounting were University of Florida graduates. Now, of course, it's much more splintered, much more diverse. And that's been something that's changed over time, that we need to work harder to maintain our position.
Among the other state schools, is there a program other than the one at FSU that competes with Florida?
We really think our main competition is outside of the state, more of like a Illinois or a Texas. Our peer schools would not include Florida State. But still, in terms of hiring graduates to go into a county within the state, Florida State would be the closest competition.
Are there any of the private schools with strong programs?
Not in the state. They're small. Stetson and one or two of the others have very good, but very small programs. Mm-hmm. No, Florida State, South Florida has a pretty big program. And
Miami.
FIU probably would be next. Central Florida is pretty big also. Mm-hmm. You know, they're good regional programs.
Central Florida had one of your graduates as its first president, Charlie Durrance.
Mm-hmm. That could be. I didn't actually know that. But
I don't know if that was good or bad. Yeah, but anyway, that's what happened.
But no, the competition in the state is a little stronger than it used to be. It is interesting that when we became a school, almost everybody else in the state except Florida State also became a school. And they still look to us and see what we're doing to a large extent.
FSU has what, a department?
Department. They never did for a number of reasons. Again, one of the reasons was the dean. The dean up there was not supportive of it. Mm-hmm. Also, the faculty were not as unified in wanting to do it as we were. And they did not have the alumni base either to do it. And they're getting more of an alumni base now.
That's a great strength of Florida.
It's a great strength.
Alumni base.
I often said, and you know, people ask, why did this work at Florida and not work in other places? And there's no single reason. There's a combination of reasons. But one of the reasons here is we had an extremely strong alumni base. Because
we had Al Warrington.
And we had some very strong key individuals. But it was beyond Al, just the numbers. I mean, Florida State did not have an accounting program until probably into the 50s. And so when 1974, most of the leading graduates in the state, leading practitioners in the state, were University of Florida graduates.
John, before you get away this afternoon, and while the tape recorder is still on, I want you to suggest to me other people to be interviewed. I have already written to Al this last week, and Bob Lancelotti, and obviously Doug Snowball's turn will come. Who else would you suggest? How about Mode Stone? Stone.
Willard Stone?
Yeah.
Willard
Stone was over in education.
I'm not sure how much help Willard would be because he was not that much involved in creating the school. Willard had built a strong department. It was department chairman for 13 years and could certainly tell you what happened just before.
Setting a stage.
But and again, Florida had a reasonably strong basis to start from, as I'd indicated, because they were ranked 27, 28th before any of us ever got here. And Willard was chairman for something like 13 years. And Willard was very supportive, very helpful, as were all the senior faculty, but they did not play a key role. They basically the notion said, look, we've done our thing. Now it's time for something new to happen.
We're going to for you young kids.
They'll let you do it. And they were great. You know, that's another thing some programs ran into is the older senior faculty did not want change. And that's something we haven't talked about that probably should be mentioned is that Willard, first and foremost, but also the other senior faculty were here, Larry Benninger, who's now deceased, D. Ray. Those three in particular were the senior faculty. There were one or two others, but they were particularly the senior faculty, and they basically said, do what you need to do, and were very supportive. So in that sense, Willard will not have been involved significantly in the creation of the school.
How about Keith Austin?
Keith was involved for a time period. I think that his involvement, he would be on the margin in terms of talking to, would be a possibility. Keith's attention in more recent years, and he and Bob Lanzotti had kind of a falling out based on the same issue, you know, of the building itself, and Keith has kind of turned his attention more to law school, but Keith is here in town and certainly worth talking to.
I know Keith.
Yeah, because it'll be low cost. Keith has not been involved with us much after that year that he chaired. He did chair the steering committee one time while I was still in office. And it was about the time we were working out the hassles over the building. And Keith has not been that active with us since then. But that would be worth talking to
him about. Are there others within the college?
No, I don't think so. You could get the college's perspective a little bit by talking with Arnold Matthews, and I've not seen Arnold for a long time.
Arnold's not well at all.
He isn't well at all. I didn't know how bad, but I knew that might be the case.
He's not good, Jay.
Arnold's a terrifically nice fellow, but Arnold and I got a little bit at cross purposes just because of these definitional things, because he was associate dean for Bob. But Arnold and I personally never had any problems, but Arnold certainly could give the perspective of the school, but if he's not well enough to talk with, I don't think there's anybody else.
I'll discuss it with Rita and see whether she thinks.
And Arnold's a wonderful guy. It would be interesting to see his perceptions from that side. I don't think there's anybody else. There are some people who were department chairman when this happened. Joe Cohen, if you really want a different perspective, Joe Cohen might be an interesting fellow to talk to. Joe and I came down at the same time.
It's Joel or Joe?
Joel, J-O-E-L. Joe and I came at the same time. He built marketing, did a great job, and is sort of now around as a senior person who built marketing and has not been in administration.
He succeeded Butterworth, I think.
That's right. Yeah. And again, it's a big turnaround. Joe also had a falling out with Bob. Almost all of us that were strong individuals did at some point.
Else is new?
Yeah. But Joel's perspective on it would be different.
Yeah.
He could give you the college perspective. Arnold's would be broader if Arnold could do it, but Joel would have
to talk to Reed and see.
I think Joel would have an interesting perspective on the school. It might be worth a bit short interview.
Is he available?
Bob would probably be available. And Bob, particularly because
he's way down in Fort Myers.
No, he's the one that's down in Miami. I think Bob would be available, would probably make the trip up. Bob chaired it the year we had, as I mentioned, the Regents celebration in Tampa. And Bob was very much involved. I think he'd be worth talking to. After Al, Bob would probably be second and third on the list. Now, another person that's here in town you could talk to would be Doug Thompson.
Yeah, I have him down here.
Doug was very active.
I do want to talk to him.
Fred Edenfield was involved. I'm not sure Fred could tell you a lot more than, say, Al, Bob, and Doug could if you talked to those three.
Mm-hmm. Jay Skelton?
Jay's perspective might be interesting because he was the only non-graduate of the University of Florida. He was very much involved. He's no longer with the firm. He left the firm. He's now he handles the personal investments of the Davis family in Jacksonville.
He's in Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm. So he's not far away. And no. Jay was also pretty close to Bob. Jay was a pretty good buffer.
I like you when you tell me they're not very far away, going all the way to Miami.
And Jay was a pretty good buffer in terms of some issues between Bob and I, because he was really close to both of us. Jay would be a possibility. Yeah. Again, once you get past Al, the drop-off's going to be significant, and then people like Bob Ellison and Jay Skelton, Fred Edenfield, Doug Thompson, they'll be able to fill in some details, but the marginal information will be a lot less than talking
about. What about members of the faculty, the accounting faculty?
Well, you talked to Doug Snowball, of course.
I'm going to talk to him. Yeah. You're my lead-off person.
I know how to say you. Yeah, you will. A person you might want to touch base with, Hadley Schaefer, was the director after me.
End of tape B, side one. The interview continues with tape B, side two.
That's S-H-A?
S-C-H-A-F-E-R, I believe is how I spelled it. Hadley was the director right after me and was the director at the time of the review when they settled our long-term.
Where is he?
He's here.
He's on the faculty?
He's on the faculty.
Oh, well, great.
And I think the other person who would know the most about has been here the whole time and was my first associate director when we organized the school, that could also give you a pretty good perspective from a faculty point of view would be a fellow by the name of Chuck McDonald.
Charles McDonald?
Mm-hmm.
He's still here.
He's still here.
And what was his role?
He was one of the strong faculty participants and was the first associate director. When we came to school and we needed an associate director because we took over increasing functions, well, he was the person I asked to be the associate director.
Okay.
And I think he would give a long-term faculty perspective.
That ought to keep me busy tomorrow.
I think it's like anything else. When you know, there are a lot of people that made this thing happen. There are a lot of people you could talk to, but you obviously have to draw a boundary around it somewhere.
So, well, I appreciate your cooperation and help.
Well, I appreciate
the support and willingness to come over here and sit down, waste a whole afternoon talking to me. It's been a great experience for me.
Definitely not wasted, and I've enjoyed it. And as I say, it's been one of those experiences that not everybody gets to have the opportunity to enjoy.
I hope it recalls some happy memories for you.
It does.